Some say it began in biblical times or even earlier, and they cite the story of Ezekiel and the wheel. Some say it dates from the famous sighting by Kenneth Arnold in 1947. And some say the precise starting point hardly matters, that unidentified flying objects, or UFOs, have been with us throughout historical times, and that they will be with us for a long time to come. Ezekiel is, perhaps, as good a time to begin as any, for it adds a historical perspective that may well be important. The story, as told in chapter 1 of Ezekiel, starts simply, "And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it. And out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire..." What follows has been analyzed in detail by writers who are convinced that this was a description of a machine, given in his own words by a man who was unfamiliar with mechanical devices and had no vocabulary for them. Are they right? Or are those men right who, like Dr. Donald H. Menzel, director of Harvard College Observatory, say that Ezekiel saw a sundog? It is hardly important. Accounts similar in their own way to that of Ezekiel have been handed down for thousands of years. At least one has come from the Egyptians, who dwelt in the Valley of the Nile almost 1,500 years before the birth of Jesus. And there are some attributed to the days of the Roman Empire. The astronomer-mathematician Jacques Vallée claims in his book Anatomy of a Phenomenon to have collected more than 300 UFO sightings that took place prior to the 20th century. It is their very number that is impressive. That, and the difficulty of assigning natural explanations for so many of them. The same problem holds true with modern sightings, the ones that, by general consent, are counted from June 24, 1947. That was the day that Kenneth Arnold, an experienced mountain flyer, sighted a flight of 9 bright, disc-shaped objects in the vicinity of Mount Rainier in the Cascade Mountains of the state of Washington. Arnold carefully noted his own position and the flight of the objects, which he estimated to be 45 or 50 feet in length and some 20 to 25 miles distant. He calculated their speed at almost 1,700 miles per hour. Arnold's sighting, judgment, and arithmetic have been argued ever since. But Edward J. Ruppelt, who once headed the United States Air Force investigations into UFO reports, concludes simply that the objects Arnold saw were unknown. The Air Force Investigating Agency has been designated by several code names, but during most of its existence, it has been known as Project Blue Book. It has collected more than 11,000 reports of UFO sightings in the United States, and it has frequently been accused of doing everything in its power to explain away each report, to attribute it to some natural and known event, no matter how far-fetched the attribution might be. In spite of that, Blue Book carries in its files some 700 sightings of objects it designates as unidentified, although in each of these cases, sufficient information was supposedly given to make an identification possible. Unofficial UFO reports, submitted to a private committee with headquarters in Washington, D.C., have on occasion run 2 and 3 times the number turned into the Air Force. And while the Air Force counts about 6% as unidentified, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena estimates that 20% of the reports it receives represent genuine mysteries. The descriptions range from the relatively conservative account given by Arnold, which might be summarized simply in the phrase unidentified flying objects, to accounts of craft that have taken a variety of forms, have actually landed, and have been occupied by strange humanoid beings. nor are the letter reports always made by wild-eyed observers. While pure hoaxes and practical jokes are often suspect, it is difficult indeed to account for such a series of sightings as that which began in Northern California back in 1896. San Francisco newspapers on November 22nd of that year were full of the story. They greeted it with a light pen, and pranksters aplenty enjoyed their hour or two upon stage. But on November 22nd, the San Francisco Examiner was forced to admit that credible witnesses had seen a lighted object in the skies over many parts of the state for the past several days, an object for which there was no satisfactory explanation. It was described as a cigar-shaped airship with what we would call propellers at either end and a long carriage beneath. No one, at that time, had built a navigable airship. As was to be the case with later UFO reports, some astronomers at the time insisted that people were merely seeing Mars or Venus, their light diffused by involvement with clouds. As was to be the case later, at least one man came forward to claim he had been taken aboard for a ride, in this instance, a 24-hour, 4,400-mile round trip to Hawaii. As was to be the case later, some of the doubters were dumbfounded. They had insisted that the sighters were being taken in by a prankster in a balloon, only to shake their heads in puzzlement when, on November 30th, the aircraft appeared flying into the wind. The San Francisco newspaper reports blossomed suddenly around November 22nd, like a field of California poppies in the sun, and they faded just as quickly. Apparently, the object had left the Bay region, but the saga was not ended. For months afterward, there were reports of similar sightings across the country as far east as Chicago and St. Louis. None was stranger or more baffling than that of Alexander Hamilton, a former congressman who maintained a farm at Leroy, Kansas. Hamilton persuaded 10 leading townsmen to sign an affidavit that his word had never been questioned and that they did verily believe his statement to be true and correct. He himself swore that on a Monday evening in April 1897, about 10:30 p.m., he, his son, and a tenant were awakened from sleep by noise among the cattle. They rushed outside to see an airship slowly descending upon a cow lot about 220 yards from the house. The three men ran to within 50 yards of the craft, Hamilton said. It was cigar-shaped, possibly 300 feet long, and had a carriage underneath made of glass or some other transparent substance, alternating with narrow strips of another material. It was, Hamilton continued, brilliantly lighted within, and was occupied by six of the strangest beings he had ever seen. The occupants were jabbering together, but the witnesses were unable to understand a word they said. The strange visitor hovered about 300 feet in the air, the account continued, directly above a squealing two-year-old heifer. When the three men reached the animal, they found a red cable about half an inch thick, fastened in a slip knot around her neck. The heifer was tangled in a wire fence. Unable to remove the cable, the men freed the animal by cutting away the wire, then stood in amazement to see the ship, heifer and all, rise slowly, disappearing in the northwest. Next evening, Hamilton learned that a neighbor some 3 or 4 miles distant had found the legs, head, and hide, identified by Hamilton's brand, in his field. There were no tracks in the soft ground around the remains. Hamilton had witnesses, including the neighboring farmer, and if he, a former congressman, were given to fantasy or joking, his fellow citizens would hardly have signed an affidavit attesting to his character. If he told the truth, what did he see? For that matter, what did the Reverend William Booth Gill, an ordained priest of the Church of England, and 37 other persons at his Papuan mission in New Guinea, see on at least four occasions more than 60 years later. As Father Gill told it to a reporter for the Sydney Australia Sun Herald, he actually exchanged semaphore greetings with the occupants of a strange craft on the evening of the 26th of June, 1959, and so did others of his group. Father Gill described a sparkling craft which descended to an altitude of between 300 and 450 feet shortly after dinner time. The ship looked like a disc with a small, rounded superstructure, he said. Admitting he was a poor mathematician, the priest estimated that the craft was about 35 feet in diameter on the lower deck and about 20 feet across on the upper. He added that it was yellowish when stationary and blue-green when in motion. But the most important and exciting thing, he said, was that there were human beings aboard. Four in all. The figures looked as though they were doing something on the top deck, he related. One figure seemed to be standing, looking down at us. I stretched my hand above my head and waved. To our surprise, the figure did the same. Others in the group of onlookers also waved and received responses. One of the mission teachers waved and flashed a torchlight at the crew, and the craft swung like a pendulum, presumably in recognition, Father Gill said. But it did not land, and beyond the casual exchange of gestures, there was no communication. Again, the narrator of impeccable character. Again, the additional witnesses. Again, the question. If Father Gill told the truth, what did he see? The Leroy, Kansas, and Papuan sightings, with their separation in time and space, and their description of crewmen, must rank among the most fantastic in the literature of UFOs. But the questions they raised could be asked many times over as report after report is examined. Other unusual craft have been seen on the ground, according to independent witnesses whose stories corroborated one another. There have been numerous descriptions of human or humanoid crewmen. Most people find it easier to believe witnesses who say simply that they have seen strange objects flying at speeds far beyond those that man-made craft can achieve in the atmosphere, or who insist they have watched them perform maneuvers that would crush a human body. Yet these reports, too, are incredible in the light of today's scientific knowledge. Whatever the source, UFO reports frequently evoke stubborn disbelief or hostility on the part of those who hear them. Although a recent Gallup poll indicates that at least 5 million Americans think they have seen strange objects in the skies, a great many citizens seem to find the reports humorous or frightening. Their reaction to UFO sighters is often one of mockery, sometimes one that verges on violence. A Michigan farmer who related that he and his son had approached a strange object in a swamp near their home had the windshield of his automobile smashed. A sign reading, "Head Martian," was taped to what was left of the glass. Hostile visitors swarmed around his farm, awakening his family in the middle of the night with taunts. Windows of a truck parked on his land were broken. Bottles were hurled at his house. In Akron, Ohio, a deputy sheriff who told how he had chased a strange flying object for 86 miles in his patrol car was so hounded, he said, that he quit his job and his wife divorced him. Reactions are usually less severe. Nevertheless, they are strong enough so that many persons who report UFOs insist upon anonymity to avoid ridicule. Dr. Henry Clay Lindgren, a social psychologist and author of numerous widely used textbooks, explains such reactions by saying that it is not normal in our culture for people to see visions. He refers to UFO sightings as visions because, as he explains, he does not know what they really are, and, for better or worse, the fellow citizens of the UFO sighters will think of them as visions. We Americans pride ourselves on our rationalism and tough-minded skepticism, Dr. Lindgren observes. We are likely to regard the UFO sighter as crazy, or at least as unstable and unreliable. What he reports, however, is disturbing. He may be right. And if he is right, what he has seen may affect the lives of all his fellow citizens. UFOs are threats merely because we do not know how to cope with them. Their unknown threat potential arouses anxiety, or even a feeling of panic. The sighters, therefore, must be rejected and put down. The better educated and more sophisticated will be content to make derogatory statements in conversation, or perhaps for publication. Less well-educated and cruder types will harass UFO sighters more or less openly. Despite Dr. Lindgren's warning and the experiences of others, people keep on seeing, or at least reporting they have seen, UFOs. The noted psychoanalyst Carl Jung has attempted to explain many such sightings as part of a collective unconscious of rumors and legends that extends into the remote past. A new type of legend, one that tends to deprecate the reports, has sprung up around the apparitions today. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, director of the Dearborn Observatory at Northwestern University and technical consultant to Project Blue Book virtually since its inception, answers some of these in a letter published in Science, the journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. It is not true, Dr. Hynek said, that only UFO addicts report strange flying objects, or that the reports come from unreliable, unstable, or uneducated people. Only a negligible handful of the reports submitted to the Air Force came from what Dr. Hynek called true believers. The most puzzling ones came from people who had given little or no thought to UFOs, and most were from persons whom he describes as obviously intelligent observers. Some of the very best, most coherent reports have come from scientifically trained people, who usually request and are granted anonymity. Commenting on the frequent declarations that UFOs are never seen at close range and are always reported vaguely, Dr. Hynek says he has several hundred reports in his files that are fine brain teasers and could easily become the subject of profitable discussion among physical and social scientists. Edward Ruppelt, the former Project Blue Book chief, also denies that UFO reports, which characteristically come in waves, are self-generating. He says that while there is some correlation between publicity and the number of sightings, it is not an established fact that reports come in only when the press is playing up UFOs. Other commentators deny the oft-heard claim that professional astronomers, who constantly watch the skies, never report UFOs. They insist there are many who ordinarily avail themselves of the guarantee of anonymity, but who include, among other notable figures, Clyde Tombaugh, the discoverer of the planet Pluto. Seen that unidentified flying objects have been reported in the skies for centuries, and we have seen something of the fantastic shapes and behavior attributed to them. We have considered the psychological reasons for some of the reactions to UFO sighters, and how the popular idea that reports come only from true believers has been refuted. It is true, of course, that the great bulk of UFO reports received by Blue Book staff members are misinterpretations of some conventional object, such as a bright planet, sun halos and sun dogs, balloons, known aircraft, and space satellites. But the hard residue of unexplained sightings demands an organized scientific research effort. Just such an effort was stimulated in 1966 by a major wave of UFO sightings. It was second only to an earlier wave in 1952. Not only did the 1966 reports approach a record in sheer numbers, but many individual sightings were made by groups of witnesses, and the descriptions were as vivid as they were hard to believe. The year's major incident was a series of reports emanating from Dexter, Michigan, and a relatively nearby college campus. The first sighting occurred on March 19th near Milan, a town about 16 miles southeast of Dexter. County police received calls that a UFO had flown over and lighted up the entire city. Officers responding to the alarm said they saw three strange flying objects, watched them for 5 hours during the early morning, and obtained photographs. The pictures were later debunked by Dr. Hynek as time exposures of the crescent moon and the planet Venus, an explanation which satisfied none of the witnesses involved. The next night, in a swamp near Dexter, a strange object was described by no less than 12 police officers and at least 35 other persons. At one point, it was said to have hovered above a swamp behind the farm home of Frank Manor. He and his son Ronald, 19, said they ran to within 500 yards of a glowing object, which they described as about the size of an automobile, the shape of a football, and textured like coral rock. It was Manor, whose auto windshield was later smashed and defaced with the label Head Martian. On the third night, an apparition was seen by between 60 and 90 co-eds who watched from dormitory windows at Hillsdale College, 45 miles southwest of Dexter. The display was described as one primarily of pulsing, moving lights in a variety of colors that hovered for hours above a swamp. Dr. Hynek, who made a field investigation of the Michigan sightings, ascribed both the pyrotechnics on the Manor farm and those seen by the college girls to swamp gas released by an early winter thaw. But William Van Horn, longtime civil defense director for the area, who saw the college display, disagreed strongly. That was in March. In April, Congressman L. Mendel Rivers, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, commented of the sightings, "We can't just write them off. There are too many responsible people who are concerned." The reports kept coming in. It was in April that Deputy Sheriff Dale Spohr of Portage County, Ohio, reported chasing an object that looked like two table saucers glued together. The description was that of a fellow officer. The chase led from a point near Ravenna, Ohio, to Conway, Pennsylvania, which is near Pittsburgh. Spohr said the object appeared definitely to be under intelligent control, that it actually maneuvered, even to the point of waiting for him when he and the other officer were delayed in what he called a mess of bridges. The object finally disappeared near Conway, going straight up, he said. Press dispatches said hundreds of persons in both Ohio and Pennsylvania reported seeing a brilliant and shiny object in the sky. But Spohr, who talked readily about his experience, in contrast to other officers who were more close-mouthed, suffered by it. He was the deputy sheriff who lost his job and his wife, and who 6 months later said he had also lost 40 pounds. His entire life came crashing down around his shoulders in a flood of reporters, television cameramen, government officials, Air Force investigators, and weird mail, he said. Still, the reports flowed in, and in October, the first truly scientific study of the phenomenon was announced. It was financed by a $300,000 research contract from the Air Force. Dr. Edward U. Condon, a distinguished physicist who formerly headed the National Bureau of Standards, was chosen to direct the project, which was undertaken at the University of Colorado at Boulder. All of the past reports from Project Blue Book were made available to the researchers. Every new sighting reported to an Air Force base in the United States was promptly forwarded to the university at the same time that duplicate copies went to Blue Book, at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and to the Pentagon. But Dr. Condon and his associates, whose work was subject to review by the National Academy of Sciences, had their job cut out for them. A major task was indexing the Blue Book files so that it would become possible to make cross-references, thus comparing sightings that were similar in type, geography, and other characteristics. Even more perplexing was the problem of devising a technique by which coherent information could be extracted from so many varying reports and reasonable inferences drawn from them. Jacques Vallée had already proposed one such approach. It consisted of classifying UFO sightings according to types: those that landed or hovered near the ground at not more than treetop height, those that were described as cylindrical and associated with diffuse clouds, those that were seen in the skies pursuing unusual flight paths, those of unusual shape that remained stationary in the sky, and those that were diffuse in outline and did not, for one reason or another, appear solid or material in substance. There would be numerous subclassifications. The astronomer-mathematician who devised the scheme suggested that such a system would make it possible to code the sightings, feed the data into computers, and perhaps come up with some basic conclusions. Computer coding was also proposed to describe the shape of the object, its motions, colors, illumination, and such characteristics as the emission of smoke, sparks, or lightning, odor and heat, spin, radioactivity, and magnetic effects. The necessity for such detail is indicated by the variety of sightings and of the effects that accompany them. Ruppelt, in his UFO book, devotes considerable space, for instance, to a series of informal experiments which strongly indicated that at least some UFOs are accompanied by emissions which affect Geiger counters. There are many reports by witnesses who say that their automobiles or motorcycles came to a sudden halt in the presence of strange hovering objects, apparently because the ignition system was affected. In one striking case, however, a diesel tractor was not halted, while a gasoline-driven machine in the same field suddenly stopped. The diesel engine fires its fuel by the heat of compression rather than by electric spark. Radio sets also have gone silent in the presence of UFO-like objects. Dr. Condon and his associates, he planned to involve as many as 100 scientists as consultants in their respective disciplines, undertook to develop a classification system which the project chief described as something along the lines that Vallée proposed, although not exactly without variations. Because of budgetary limitations, $300,000 is not an overwhelming grant as modern research efforts go. The Condon group could not undertake field work on sightings outside the United States. Although foreign governments have shown less official curiosity about UFOs than the United States, these sightings have occurred in large numbers, have been extensively reported in the press of each nation, and are important. It would be extremely difficult, for instance, to judge the validity of waves of UFO reports in the United States unless they could be compared with those in other nations. The 1952 American wave, which included the largest number of reports yet received in a single year, was paralleled by a similar crescendo of sightings in France and other countries. Although field investigation abroad was financially impossible, the Condon group did not ignore the foreign sightings. They asked for and received from Jacques Vallée some 3,000 IBM cards that contained coded reports of UFO sightings, almost half of them from beyond the continental United States. Thus, the University of Colorado researchers were equipped beyond the limits of their grant when they undertook their labors. They also consulted with Dr. Hynek, who had written in his letter to Science, "I cannot dismiss the UFO phenomenon with a shrug. The hard data cases contain frequent allusions to recurrent kinematic, geometric, and luminescent characteristics. I have begun to feel that there is a tendency in the 20th century science to forget that there will be a 21st century science, and indeed, a 30th century science, from which vantage points our knowledge of the universe may appear quite different. We suffer, perhaps, from temporal provincialism, a form of arrogance that has always irritated posterity." To that, many of his colleagues would say, "Amen." But the UFO phenomenon is complex and an explanation difficult. It may be, as a few serious observers have suggested, that people have been seeing spacecraft that come from other worlds. It may be that UFOs are a social and psychological phenomenon, at least in large part. It may be that there are natural forces at work in the atmosphere and on the surface of our planet with which we are not at all familiar. Speculation can be, indeed has been, almost endless, because one question to another. As an example, perhaps the most popular of all is the suggestion that UFOs are actually spacecraft from another world, a world which has had the Earth under scrutiny for thousands of years, patiently watching the development of civilization here. If so, where is that other world? Modern astronomy offers no reason to expect advanced life forms on other planets in our own solar system. Venus, if we're to trust the findings of the Mariner 2 space probe, is an unbearably hot world, probably a global desert. Mars may possibly be the home of a relatively simple form of vegetation, but it's difficult to make a reasonable argument for anything more highly developed. And the other planets of our own system are even less promising. Mercury is far too hot and has only a barely detectable atmosphere. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, all too cold and inhospitable. They lie outside the sun's life support zone. If the UFOs are extraterrestrial spacecraft, then it would appear that they must come from a planet that circles one of the distant stars. Most astronomers agree that in all probability there are many other suns with planets that could support well-developed life forms. It's their distance that places an insurmountable obstacle in the path of spacecraft from such worlds, an obstacle at least that is insurmountable in the light of our own technology. The nearest star system to us, a triple sun, is Alpha Centauri. Because of the complex orbit a planet would follow in such a system, there is little likelihood that advanced life exists there. The nearest stars where life-supporting planets may exist are at a distance of 10 light years from us, each light year representing the distance that light travels in a year at a speed of 186,000 miles per second. The problems inherent in traveling across such distances are staggering. If we supply the most efficient nuclear fuels, it would nevertheless have to carry billions of tons of fuel for each ton of its own weight on any interstellar journey to be completed within the span of a human lifetime. If we adopt the more economical and fuel-saving plan of coasting, the method the Mariner probes used to reach Mars and Venus, then we must reckon on a journey that lasts for many hundreds of years. It will be a long time, if ever, before man can contemplate seriously such a venture into interstellar space. Yet, if we're to accept the idea that UFOs have come from beyond the solar system, we must acknowledge a civilization so far beyond ours that it can mount not a single such expedition, but an almost casual parade of a variety of vehicles that have been making the excursion for perhaps thousands of years. Enthusiasts argue, however, that there may be undiscovered energy sources that could make it all possible, or that still unknown secrets of the geometry of space would make it far easier than we think. The ramifications continue. If UFOs are visiting spacecraft, why haven't they attempted to communicate with us? Why haven't they tried to rescue us from our own follies? Could it be that a race so far advanced finds Earth's environment one in which it cannot survive, and this a problem it cannot overcome? Or do they merely study us with the same detachment, the same mental and spiritual separation from their subject that the entomologist feels for a colony of ants? No speculation seems too fantastic for the dyed-in-the-wool UFO believer. Thus, one hears the suggestion that the visitors may be not from another world, but from our own Earth of the distant future. That they are time travelers. This might resolve the question of lack of contact. As any reader of science fiction knows, such historical investigators from the future might be allowed to observe, but they could never interfere. If they did, they would change the shape of the very future from which they came. Travel through time, of course, has been a favorite subject for literary dreaming since the days of H.G. Wells and his time machine. But time itself is largely a mystery. And although there is learned argument that it may be reversible, there is equally learned and compelling rebuttal that such a thing is impossible. Explanations of UFOs as natural, physical, or psychological phenomena plunge into equally unplumbed depths. And so, every speculation about their origin ends as it began, without an answer, and with some who will support almost any idea that is offered. Certain things are true, however. If the objects that witnesses have reported are actually maneuverable air or spacecraft, they would seem to represent something that is foreign to every nation on Earth. If they are natural phenomena, they are strangers to our sciences. If they are in the minds of the beholders, they represent depths of the human spirit that have so far been largely unexplored. Whatever they are, they may well have been with us since biblical times. They have had their counterparts in the intervening years, and they have returned in which may represent no more than the improvement in communications during the past 20 years. And they are worthy of serious attention. For when we have finally learned the truth about the myriad UFO sightings, we may well have learned important new truths about ourselves, our world, or even, despite all the arguments against it, about worlds that lie among the stars.